Today's episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
Are we ready to go? We're all dancing, man. We're all dancing.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for the after credit scene.
Dance party. Dance.
See, the song should be playing right now, and I'm singing along with it.
Singing along with it.
I'll have to sync it up.
We should, we should definitely get some... Yeah. Some video feed.
We should,
just down up.
Show a white guy dancing.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll show you dancing.
It's all shoulder dancing.
Like a close-up of you dancing with your name at the bottom.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then a close-up of Jeremy with his name at the bottom.
Yeah.
It'll just be like a...
And we game for the camera. Yeah.
Like a 70s splash.
Yes.
Love it.
Oh, hey, everybody. Welcome to Slate House Publishing Presents. Hey, I got it right this time. Lit Bits.
That might be the first time that you've done it.
I missed it.
No. I'm here with, this is Jeremy, I'm here with Trevor and Curtis, and we are talking to you today about some of the best and worst films that have come to us this fall 2021.
Yeah, man.
Man, and there have been some real humdingers, let me tell you.
For better
some
or for worse.
And some bad.
Some hum and some dingers.
Some hum and dingers.
Some hum and dingers. So let's just jump right into it. I didn't go see Last Night in Soho, but I've heard it's Last Night in So-So.
Yeah, I saw Last Night in Soho, Last Night in Fayetteville, Arkansas. No, it wasn't literally last night.
Is it even still in theaters?
It is, yeah, it's still there. Oh, okay. You could go see it tonight if you wanted to.
I could, or I could just go see Ghostbusters again.
Yeah, well, between the two, I would probably go see Ghostbusters again.
Which is
weird because they're both about ghosts.
Yeah.
But, like, well, I mean, Ghostbusters is not, let's be real, it's not really about ghosts. Because those aren't really ghosts. Like there's something completely
there's a ghost in it.
But they're not ghosts. Well, there's one ghost.
There's
in
one.
It. There's
yeah.
one ghost.
We're jumping the gun though. Let's not get to it just
yeah,
yet.
Yeah. All right. So Last Night in Soho has.
That's
ghosts
how bad
in
Last
it.
Night
actually,
in Soho is that we want to talk about. Ghost
yeah. Let's talk about the other movie.
Yeah. It's definitely on my mind. I don't know why. So Edgar Wright directed this movie. He has done a whole bunch of other stuff. Like
and he
great
helped write
stuff.
It with Christy Wilson Cairns. I keep wanting to mispronounce her name.
Yeah, I mean, so Edgar Wright did Shaun of the Dead. He did Hot Fuzz. He's done, the End of the World, I think. He did Baby Driver most recently.
Oh, yeah.
So he's done some interesting movies, but for some reason or another, this movie just did not work for me. For one thing, it's super repetitive. The story is about this girl played by Thomasin McKenzie who can, like, see ghosts from the past or something, and she begins living back through the life of another woman from the 60s in Soho, right, in this like subdivision of London, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. Not the subdivision of London, but
the subdivision of London was played by Anya Taylor-Joy.
You know, she's got range.
I just stumbled through that.
She's got
she's
range.
Got the range for it.
Yeah.
I don't know, like the street, she's a little flat.
Yeah.
You know what kind of method acting she had to do to get that together?
Right, right.
Go lay down on a pothole.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's all she did. She just stood very still the whole movie. No, it's about, like, Anya Taylor-Joy in the past is like, she wants to break out into showbiz, and then she's kind of wooed by Matt Smith, who, like, turns her into a prostitute, right? That's basically, and then... Thomasin McKenzie has to like live through all of these traumatic experiences that Anya Taylor-Joy goes through.
Now the IMBD said this also had OG General Zod from like Superman 2.
Terrence Stamp is in there for about like 20 seconds of airtime.
Okay, cool.
I mean he's there.
So he is top billing.
He doesn't really. He doesn't. No, I don't think he did. I think Anya Taylor-Joy got top billing.
She probably did
in this movie. Yeah, Terrence Stamp is in there for just a little bit of time. He doesn't really have any weight on the plot. The plot meanders so hard. Diana Riggs is in here. She was like my OG crush. Like Diana Riggs from seeing her in her leather cat suit in Avengers.
Oh, yeah, okay.
The 60s British adventure show,
yeah.
Right?
I was trying to place her.
Yeah, holy shit. She was so fine, and now she's like a grandma, and
it's kind of... now she's kind of weird. Oh, she was on Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, was she? Yeah.
She was okay. The one who... Spoiler alert. The one who poisoned Joffrey.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Spoiling a movie, a TV show that ended like two or 3 years ago.
Honestly, she's she's
welcome
fine
to the
in
club, Curtis.
Yeah,
you spoiled your first old...
Yeah, my first spoiler alert.
Yeah. She was, I don't know, she's fine in this movie. I like the performances in this movie. I think Thomasin McKenzie is way manic. Like she tilts from being like, I understand her energy to being like, really, okay, can you tone it back just a little bit, please? I've loved her in everything else I've seen. She was the teenager in Old.
Yeah.
You know, one of the teenagers anyway.
That, did you really love her in everything else you've seen then?
I mean, I don't love that movie, but I think she did fine.
Old is the primordial ooze that this podcast was
forged
that's
right.
In.
Yeah. That's the first episode.
Or as Jeremy says, that fucking movie.
Yeah, that fucking movie. I'm still not over it. I'm still mad about that movie. Yeah. All that time I lost.
Yeah.
Thomasin McKenzie was also in Jojo Rabbit. I loved her in that movie. That movie's great.
See, I really still want to see that.
Seen. Yeah, I need to see that.
You guys got to
watch
that. That's
the Hitler movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Slay House Movie Party. Because
there's only
Jojo
one
Rabbit.
Of those.
Jojo.
Only one Hitler movie.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
The one I want to see. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I just.
Forget
I,
you, Last I felt... Crusade.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones.
okay. Have I shared my Indiana Jones story on here before?
I don't know. Have you
with Max McCauley, the author?
Nope. I don't think so.
Oh,
share
man.
It. Share
right.
it. This is a, this is a movie review.
Aside.
This is a movie review. So share it. Yeah.
It's an aside. All right. So I went, my undergrad was at Emporia State University, and one of the tenured professors there in creative writing is this guy named Matt McCauley, or Max McCauley. He wrote a bunch of novelizations of Indiana Jones. And like the expanded universe for Star Wars, mm-hmm. he did that for Indiana Jones.
Is he the only one who did that?
There were a couple, but he's written several of them, okay. right? So my professor at Emporia State University, she was like, in my intro to lit class, she was like, let's read, we're going to read some genre work and we're going to talk about genre. And she was like, I have this book here that I want you to read. It's Indiana Jones and like the Hollow Earth or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I read this book. I read this Indiana Jones book. And as an undergrad, I read it with the same energy that I read everything for this podcast. And so like all of the things that I've said about like Star Wars in our previous Star Wars
episode.
I said like straight up to my teacher, to my professor in college, and we had a guest speaker that day who I did not recognize as Max McCauley, author of the book itself. I went full tilt into his book, slammed his book in front of everybody. Cause she asked like, what were your thoughts? And I was like, can we talk about this book? Because it's fucking insane. And I went into like all of the plot bits that I was like, and this French guy shows up and what is he doing here? And I'm like, I was just really critical of this book. And so at the end of my rant, I see this other professor who's there as a guest, and he is laughing his ass off. Laughing. And he turns and my professor was like, right, well, this is Max McCauley. He's the author. And I was like, oh fuck,
I gotta go.
Yeah. So at the end of his little, you know, presentation on like writing and stuff like that, all of the kids go up to have their books signed by Max McCauley, and I'm the last in the line, of course. So I get to him and I hand him my book and I say, hey, will you go ahead and sign this for me? And he goes, no, I think I'm good.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, he did.
He did not. Was he really for real?
I mean, I think he took it in stride, but he never signed my book. And so,
that's salty. That's salty.
I'm like the only kid.
I'm gonna see if he's
class.
On Twitter, and I'm gonna tag him when we upload this episode, and see if we can get his perspective on this. This
is sign my book.
That is hilarious. So that's our review of Last Night in Soho.
Right. It was so uninteresting.
We've not got
things back on track.
So, I mean, I'm sure the entire world, except for me, and I'm just probably, this is going to be the one MCU film that I just don't see with any kind of enthusiasm. I guess everyone else has seen The Eternals, so do we want to talk about it?
I mean, just briefly, bummed me out. It really did.
Tell us how you really feel, Trevor.
I walked into this movie feeling like I knew that it was going to be kind of not good.
I mean, the reviews were all over the place before.
They were. And a lot of people were like, but it's Marvel. And Marvel's done everything great. And I'm like,
when
yeah,
the dude from NPR who hates on Marvel says it's going to be a good movie, you know it's going to be a bad movie.
Right.
Well, Glenn Weldon has never really, let's be real, he's never really hated on Marvel.
So I'm tagging him in this episode as well, too,
yeah, that's right,
right,
yeah.
From a
Glenn will tell you. Glenn's very active on Twitter. I don't know. This movie just bummed me out. I just, there are many things that I love watching in a superhero movie. Like, having superheroes just stand around for 3 hours talking about their feelings is not one of them. It's just not something I'm very interested in.
What?
Yeah.
Today on Jerry Springer, we have Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, and it's Are You the Father?
Oh my God, you wrecked my home!
Martha!
Martha, why'd you say that name?
Throw the chair! Throw the chair!
Jerry!
Settle down.
No, this movie is, I felt exhausted by it. Like, there are parts of the movie that I think don't make any sense logically to the plot. Like, they introduce these villains. I'm a spoil some shit. Right here.
Spoil it.
I'm spoiling it.
Spoil it like
10
day old milk.
So the idea is that these Eternals are like these beings created by Celestials, which are like the gods of the Marvel Universe, right? And they come and they're supposed to protect humankind from the Deviants, which is just a stupidly named weirdo creature thing.
The
creature
race.
Yeah, so they come in to like genocide the Deviants. And for the whole movie, you're kind of set up like, oh, so the Deviants are really the bad guys. And then, like, after the first act of the movie's like, no, but the Deviants aren't really the bad guys at all. And I'm like, well, then why did I just spend 40 fucking minutes watching a movie about, like, setting up the conflict between the Eternals and the Deviants?
Oh,
yeah, they were just really into BDSM. That's why they're called the Deviants. No, but so these Eternals, you know, are in conflict with the Deviants. And then after the first act of the movie, it's like, oh, but that's not even the conflict that you should care about. And I'm like, so then what the fuck am I watching?
Yeah.
So then they kind of like spend the rest of the movie trying to reorient who the bad guys of the movie are. But the Deviants are still showing up and just wrecking shit. And you're like, I'm still supposed to care about
I'm
this
just
dumb
pissed they killed off Salma Hayek. That would be the only reason I
yeah,
could watch that
off
film.
Screen and then like you don't even like, yeah she's not even in the majority of the movie.
Like all it took was From Dusk Till Dawn and then that movie, what was it, Fools Rush In or something with her and Matthew Perry. And
I mean I
will go see Salma Hayek and everything.
I like her in virtually
can I
anything,
tag Salma Hayek
sure.
in this
I don't think she's going to listen to me slam her movie.
I do like me some
no,
Salma.
No, we're slamming the movie. We're not slamming her.
Oh, no. Salma Hayek. And let me be clear. Like,
easy, Jeremy.
About this movie. This movie has some fine performances.
Just kidding,
like,
honey, to my wife.
Gemma Chan, I liked her in this movie. I liked Richard Madden. I liked Kumail Nanjiani. I liked Kit Harington. I liked Salma Hayek. I liked Angelina Jolie. Like,
it has some good actors.
It's got some great
some
actors.
A-list
and
actors.
The acting is not my problem with this movie. My problem is, like, plot-wise, it makes no fucking sense at all. And, like, and so
written,
much of the conflict is given to characters that I don't give a shit about because there are 10 of them and none of them have very much dimension. So, like, story-wise, I'm just not there.
Yeah. Mm. For me, the too many characters has always been a problem for me. Like, yeah. How am I supposed to give a shit about each and every yeah. one of you?
And yeah. it might work in a series that's 20 films long. You know, right. when I go and I watch Infinity War or something like that, I have stakes in all of the characters because I've seen them in their own media elsewhere.
Right.
So when something happens to Doctor Strange, I'm like, oh no, Doctor Strange, I loved you in that movie.
Right, right. There's like an organic kind of coming together.
Exactly.
Over a long period of time,
exactly.
Rather than just shoving
so
this
I know
cast
what the stakes are. But then when you bring me 10 people in a movie and the right. movie's only got a 2.5 hour runtime and they're like, care about this character. I'm yeah. like, fucking, I can't.
And
you
most
can't manufacture.
I think
that.
A lot of people are like, well, I do and I will because this is a Marvel movie. And that's
yeah,
just what,
right, yeah.
you know, I'm going to do it
but,
no matter what.
But that was another thing, you know, like, whereas I feel like I walk into Captain America with all of my expectations about what I know about Captain America, I'm a huge nerd. I only knew who the Eternals were by, like, the title. Like, I knew who they are because I actually do have one of the miniseries runs of the Eternals. But, like, I couldn't tell you very much more about them other than that they exist. You know, I had no real – I wasn't coming in –
And they always will.
Yeah, I wasn't coming in with a connection to these characters. So I was, like, expecting the movie to give me something to connect to.
Right.
And it just doesn't happen.
It's
I just
funny.
Don't
it's
think
almost
it
like DC tried to catch up to Marvel, right, by throwing a whole bunch of characters into a couple of different movies and try and play catch up really quickly with them.
Yeah.
And it fell flat. And now Marvel has almost done the exact same thing.
Almost. Like, with yeah. one of their franchises.
With one right. of their franchise, yeah.
It really
yeah.
feels like these massive corporations just battling each other.
It
like,
does.
You know,
oh, for sure. Very
you
cynically.
Know, it's just a business kind
yeah,
of thing.
Very it, cynically, yeah. I you know,
now,
it's
hey guys,
like
now
how
I'm
I
daydreaming
Star Wars.
When Slay House is that big that we can be a massive corporation just battling each other and throwing schlock out just to...
Yes. yes.
And just raking
We can aspire, folks. We can aspire.
Never be outdone.
So... So yeah, the Eternals. I mean, but it made some money, so there you go. But
yeah.
let's look at the next one on our
they
list.
They all do.
Some do. Antlers didn't. Antlers made. It looks like almost it made back exactly what the budget
yeah.
was.
I meant all Marvel movies.
I feel like Antlers is a movie that will do better in streaming. Like
yeah,
once
I
it,
agree.
Once it's finally on a platform. Than it would in theaters.
I mean, I'll totally watch it again. I enjoyed the movie. It had some issues. It wasn't perfect, but I did. Overall, I enjoyed the movie. For one, it's a great horror film that's showcasing a monster that we are not as, like, I'm familiar with it because I'm familiar with all things horror, but a lot of people may not be as familiar with this idea of, like, a Wendigo or this Native American spirit.
Yeah.
And I find that they showcased it in this movie. I just thought it was beautifully done. It was a great mix of like CGI and practical effects.
There is some, yeah, that was the thing that struck me a lot about this movie is that the blend of CGI with practical effects works wonderfully on the screen.
And it was atmospherically beautiful. Like it was not, it was very unsettling looking. It really played with the setting really well.
Yeah.
It didn't rely on a bunch of jump scares, but
there were a couple that got me out
you.
Of my seat. Like it got me.
Me and Trevor and my wife went to see this at the same time, like all together. And all three of us, like my wife never jumps at films. And that scene that, and Trevor knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And it not only gets you in the initial jump scare, but then it does it again. And you're like, I wasn't.
It's a jump scare it liked so much, it did it twice.
Yeah. And it works. It works. And,
it got me both times.
It did.
I was
It got my wife. My wife never jumps at this stuff, and she jumped. And
I was expecting it, but I was not expecting it the same way twice.
I think we all three looked at each other after that and just grinned and like, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
It works. All right. I think, looking back on this movie, which had a lot going for it,
mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that I kind of struggle with is just taking something that's a Native American myth with its own kind of allegory and then trying to create a new allegory on top of it, like to use it as your own allegory.
Yeah. Right.
So in this movie, the Wendigo, I think, is an allegory for like paternal abuse or for child abuse,
mm-hmm.
right? And with the trauma that comes from that, so the characters in this book, all of them suffered some kind of trauma through child abuse, mm-hmm. and are coping with it in different ways. And so the Wendigo just becomes a manifestation of that trauma as they try to grapple with it. And so I don't know. I
kinda
feel like
it. It sounds like
a little bit.
That's
what I'm thinking right now.
A little
now,
bit. Yeah. So I just I struggled at times because I felt like this allegory isn't really quite coalescing the way that I think they want it to. And I also I'm kind of like they treat the Wendigo and the transformation that people go through, you know, when they're cursed with this Wendigo curse or whatever. They treat it as though it's contractible, like vampirism or lycanthropy is contractible. And I don't know how much that fits in with like the Native American mythology, and
so let me,
and it was kind of weird to me.
Yeah. So let me address the Native American mythology, because being just a tad more familiar with it tells me how I see what they're doing with this movie.
Yeah.
And that's why it does kind of work for me. So the Wendigo is, it's an allegory against cannibalism. It's addressed to a populace of Native Americans.
And kind of isolationism, right?
Right. It's isolationist. It's addressed to a population, a Native American population. It's really prominent in like northern tribes, where there was food insecurity at certain times of the year.
Yeah.
And so they warned against like, no, if you eat this other person, and it was contracted almost like vampirism, like the Wendigo would be a spirit that would come in and force you to cannibalize, like you'd be so hungry you'd eat another one of your tribesmen or one of another person. And then after you did that, you yourself would become the Wendigo.
Right. Oh. You become the monster, right?
Yeah.
The curse kind of settles on you for the violence that you've done against
right.
you know, someone else.
And so that idea of food insecurity and this impoverished and isolationist kind of community, is being played into in this movie, because they are in this like little mountain setting in Oregon, and they are like, this is a very impoverished town. Like
everybody is
poor.
Yeah.
And in fact, the idea of like this idea of cannibalism and food and providing for people is, played out with the dad who becomes the Wendigo, like the father figure for the little boy.
Yeah.
Because he finds the creature, he's attacked by the creature and becomes the creature because he's a meth dealer. He's like cooking meth in the mines. And that play on this emaciated kind of look and playing with that, the effects of that drug and stuff, I feel like kind of go well together. And I think when we do see later in the film that the guy that was with him when he's making meth at the beginning of the film, we see half the body, like half the torso. I think what we're seeing is the Wendigo possesses the guy. He eats his friend in the mine. We find the half of the corpse later on, and that's how he becomes the Wendigo. So I think it is playing into the legends.
I guess so the meth dealer guy, though, is attacked by a Wendigo to begin with and then turns into the Wendigo.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of how it works.
Right.
I don't know. I
kind of like with Jesse Plemons later in the movie.
He gets
attacked by the Wendigo, and then later it's implied that he's becoming the Wendigo.
But I think at that point in time, you know, the implication is really like he's infected by the trauma that he suffered as a child through his own, you know, child abuse. Like that's kind of what they're using that for. It's just messy to me.
Yeah.
And the reason why
it could have been done a little clearer.
Yeah, I think the reason why it just didn't quite connect to me is that like I know these things about what the Wendigo is and what the Wendigo does. And then as a result, you know, when I see them trying to use it to allegorize something, I'm kind of like, but it already is an allegory. And so now you're like taking this allegory and changing it for yourself.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just I didn't.
Did it feel like they were appropriating it?
A little bit.
Yeah. I could see that.
I felt a little bit like that, but I also felt like
we say that not knowing the background of Scott Cooper,
right?
Like,
who wrote
the screenplay and wrote the short story.
And this is also produced by like Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. Scott Cooper was the director. This is Nick Antosco, who wrote the screenplay.
I don't really care too much about appropriation because I think that there's a difference between like true appropriation, which is like this is original to my culture,
yeah,
when it is not, and right. claiming that it's part of your rich heritage when it is not, that yeah. is appropriation. Yeah. Right, I don't right. believe that appropriation okay. is just I'm wearing a dress that traditionally belongs to another, you know, group of people. Because it's not. I'm not saying that this is part of my cultural
he is
heritage.
He's wearing a dress today,
I am
folks.
Saying that it's something. Well, yeah.
It's a slick
listen,
back
Harry Styles taught me to. I'm pushing back.
Oh, it's actually Harry. Got a slit all the way up to his thigh. It's really actually kind of disgusting.
Oh, well, I
please
just
cross your legs, Trevor.
I haven't shaved
please.
Today.
let me ask a question. If you, like you know a lot of things about the Wendigo, and so that affects the way you interpret the movie and
kinda,
how you feel
yeah.
about. What do you think it would? The impression would be somebody who has no idea, like me, who has no yeah. idea what that story is about.
It could probably hit very differently.
Yeah. Would it make right? sense to, yeah. to a person?
Oh, I think it does make sense. Okay. I mean, like, I feel like you would be able to track a lot of what the movie's playing.
I don't think right. there's a lot of movies on this list that we would advise people necessarily to go see, but I yeah. do feel like even though we have these criticisms of this one, I yeah. think it is one that we would
no,
say definitely go see
on the whole,
this.
Right. I enjoyed this movie a lot.
I didn't I enjoy like... it on the whole. The antlers were a little sharp.
Yikes! Oof!
There it is. I was waiting for the first one.
You really have to time these things perfectly, folks. That's, yeah, yeah. that's the trick behind good comedy and making
it's
a
really
pun work.
It's really on me for just walking into it.
Yeah.
He backed
yeah.
into it.
I really backed into it. Should have been watching.
Oh, my God.
All right.
Yeah, no, just to kind of sum that up, you know, there are some movies that I feel like they try something new, like Night House, and that did not pay off for me.
Right.
I really was frustrated by Night House because I felt like the allegory or the story that they were going for, the symbolism they were going for, did not work for me. Whereas right. I feel like on the whole, this one feels a little better, but it still is kind of messy, and that's kind of why yeah. I say, like, it's not that I didn't have my problems with it, but right. I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ron's Gone Wrong.
Listen, I don't know why.
I didn't see this one, folks.
I don't know why. I just really
I haven't seen any of these.
I like, yeah, I like kids' movies sometimes.
Your like, kids might like, would his kids like?
Probably.
Ron's
yeah,
Gone Wrong.
This feels like a movie that's very manufactured for family-friendly entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. I just have to be really case by case about it. It's not really like a
no. That's
oh
cool.
yeah.
A code
yeah.
I go by.
No, I think
Ron's
that,
Gone Wrong.
Yeah, it's got Zach Galifianakis and Ed Helms in it.
Oh, that's a PG movie.
Yeah, Zach mm-hmm. Galifianakis plays a robot.
Oh my God,
that
he is my favorite.
Oh really?
I love that man.
He plays a robot that has like a manufacturing defect.
Number five, come
so
alive.
That like yeah, no, it's very like that. It's very like it's got the same kind of vibe. Basically, he's supposed to be this friend to a little kid, but like all of his safety settings are off, and like the algorithm that is supposed to make him friendly is just kind of wonky. So he's very friendly, but he's also terrifying. And I don't know why. There are some really good dark jokes in this movie that just got me. Like, first off, he only like in terms of the dictionary that downloads for his little robot brain or whatever, he only has like an encyclopedic knowledge of words that begin with A. and so it's like trying to get understand this kid's name, and this kid I forget the kid's name, but basically the robot thinks that his name it like pitches names to him. It's like Aaron,
it's Barney,
Adam. Oh yeah, the kid's name is Barney.
Yeah.
So but it gets through, and the kid's like, my name's not Aaron, it's not Adam, and it's like Absalom, and he's like Absalom, and he's like, correct, so your name is Absalom, and like with
confirm.
That intonation with the question mark, you know, at the end of it. So throughout the whole movie he's like, where are you going, Absalom? Like, it's so funny. I don't know why that joke works for me so well.
It sounds kind of like Big Hero 6. Did you see that movie?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Is it like that?
It's absolutely got some Baymax vibes.
Okay.
Like, for sure.
I really like that movie.
Yeah, for sure. It's got the same kind of like goofy robot humor.
The robot buddies always yeah. work in the movies.
Yeah. So but there are some great, like I said, some great dark jokes. At one point in time,
like Chucky?
the robot. Yeah. The robot is like trying to figure out everything about Barney to like, you know, be his best friend or whatever. And he tears the head off of like Barney's little stuffed bunny or whatever. And he's like, what did you do? He's like, I had to find out everything about you. So I did. And I found out that the bunny's head rips off after 45 square inches of, or like
he knows the 40, math.
Yeah, 45 pounds per square inch of force or whatever. and so he runs into a chicken later, and the robot grabs the chicken by the head and the body and starts stretching, and he's just counting. He's going 42, 43. It's so dark.
Bunny's like, shit.
Yeah, but it works. So I thought that the joke's really good. If you're a cynical millennial and you watch this movie and you're like, yeah, everything's a big corporation and none of that is good, you'll get really cynical about the ending to this movie too, because it's a child's movie and it's very didactic. But at the same time, I had a blast with it. I'm not going to rank it in like my favorite children's movies or anything, but in terms of like non-objectionable kids movies, I had a good time with it. I thought it was pretty fun.
Nice.
Well, that time was good. What about No Time to Die? See what I did there?
I really...
I see.
Is that... Yeah.
Yeah. No Time to Die.
The Segway Master.
I don't know. It felt like maybe it's No Time to Die, but it definitely killed my interest in this franchise.
It did?
Yeah.
Did it? Was it bad?
I did not like it.
You know, Daniel Craig said before they even thought about doing this movie, said a long time ago, they asked him, are you going to do any more 007 films? And he said, I would rather die than do another 007 film.
Well,
I mean,
he did one. So yeah. I was like, should I watch this?
And
I
don't.
Because from what I know, he doesn't give a shit about this movie.
And he dies at the end of it. Like, spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert, they actually kill off James Bond.
Oh my God.
This is not the end of James Bond movies.
Right. Because you can go with a different timeline.
Right. Just a different character. Like, you know, I felt like for me, what made this Bond so interesting is the sense of continuity they give to Daniel Craig's character and the way that Daniel Craig develops over the course of the movie. So this, you know, you see a different James Bond, like he's going through different stuff in each movie.
Right.
And as a result, the character, I think, just evolves, becomes very different. And feels so much differently than any of the James Bonds that came before it.
It's kind of like what they did with Batman. He's just a little bit one-dimensional character that threw his thing, and then over time, it's like, what's his deal?
Yeah,
you know, like what?
No doubt. So
that's kind of cool.
This movie, I think, as a capstone to a project to kind of bring James Bond into the 21st century and make him a more nuanced character than just dude who fucks bitches and drives cars.
That really won't fly today, will it? I mean, the traditional 007 is not going to work now. Go back and watch any
James Bond prior to Daniel Craig in today's like cultural climate.
Even the Pierce Brosnan ones.
And I loved Pierce Brosnan and Sean Connery's versions.
Yeah, I still love the Sean Connery movies, but there are some problems.
Do you remember Denise Richards in that
Pierce
one?
Brosnan?
Oh yeah.
Whoa, that's some bad acting, dude.
Her acting
is rough.
I mean, she's a very good-looking woman, but let's be real. She cannot act her way out of a
paper
bag.
It makes me like her, though. It actually makes me like her. Like, her acting is so bad, but she just insists on doing it.
I feel like she's just so genuine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, she genuinely wants to be there. She genuinely is giving it her best shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like on Starship Troopers. She was.
I unironically love Starship Troopers love her in Starship Troopers.
Same here.
Yeah. Yeah,
for sure.
True.
Yeah. When she got stabbed in the thing or whatever, and she went, it hurts so bad.
I mean,
she was doing her Arnold.
Give me the choice between Denise Richards and not Denise Richards. Like, I'm gonna watch Denise Richards.
I like Denise.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is James Bond.
I thought you were going to say Arnold Schwarzenegger as Denise Richards.
Oh, no, no, no. That's not subtle enough. Bond has to be subtle.
Yeah.
You can't be Schwarzenegger walking into a casino.
No.
Because all eyes immediately go to him.
Right.
No. Well, he kind of was James Bond in True Lies, though. I mean, that was
True Lies is a great... We were just talking about this. True Lies is probably peak 90s.
It's really good.
I mean, he really was James Bond in that film.
Oh,
I mean, he gets out of the scuba gear and he's got the tuxedo
And Jamie Lee Curtis
on.
Is the Bond girl. Dude, like...
Oh, yeah.
Movies in the 90s were just inexplicably good.
Oh, yeah.
That movie is peak 90s.
Yeah.
Tia Carrera's in that movie.
Tia Carrera?
Mm-hmm.
Heck yeah.
He did the whole Bond girl being a villain and then the true Bond girl thing before I think James Bond, like those 007 movies did it. Like, I don't know if they'd done it. Maybe they had done it. Maybe that's where he got the idea.
Who did it?
Cameron and James Cameron? That True Lies. Yeah.
I was like, when did...
Because then you get... The spy who's
the gorgeous femme fatale spy. I mean, yeah, it's been done before. But he did it so well in that movie.
It was so good.
No, I think what works about that movie is that James Cameron just steers directly into the tropes of that whole genre.
and turns it on your head and just plays with them and
delivers kind of a balls to the wall.
And he put Tom Arnold in it, which Tom right over the top.
It's funny. Yes. Like, it's genuinely funny and self-aware of its own stupid jokes
Tom Arnold talking about his wife leaving him, and he's like, what kind of bitch takes the ice cube trays out of the freezer?
That's his big issue.
It's so funny. No, that movie is stellar. So anyway,
so that's our review of No Time to Die.
Back to No Time to Die.
You only thought you were getting a review of the movies that just came out. We're actually using them to segue off.
You don't know where this is going.
All our 90s films. I felt like this, again, to just kind of wrap it up, like, I felt like this movie was very underwhelming because as much as they try to evolve the character of Bond for me, the plot just really did not work.
Bummer.
It was way too convoluted. And then on top of that, I really just felt like they did a terrible job establishing Rami Malek as this villain. Like, this villain is the most one-note villain I have encountered in a long time.
Dude, that guy, I like him a lot, but unfortunately the thing that I liked him most on was Saturday Night Live.
Oh, really?
I mean, when I watched the Queen movie, didn't work for me. Has he found his spot yet, or is he kind of...
I really don't think so.
Still trying to fit him into different
slots. I think they're trying to find the right place for him.
He was in that show Mr. Robot, too.
He'll get there, for sure.
Mr. Robot was pretty good. He had a part in a video game horror movie, which I thought was pretty good. He was also in... Wasn't he in a movie recently with... It was like another thriller movie with the bad Joker guy.
Oh, Jared Leto?
Jared Leto.
The bad Joker.
Oh, yeah. Didn't we see that?
Yeah, we watched it.
Denzel Washington.
It was like a PI crime thriller kind of movie.
I felt like he was pretty okay in that movie
as kind of a junior cop. He was the junior cop.
He was the young cop.
That's right.
Like the young FBI guy.
That really should have been on our... Boy, that's bad.
It was called The Little Things.
The Little Things. It came out a while ago.
Did we watch it during this fall?
No, we didn't watch it this fall.
So it should have been in our summer.
It was like a year ago that it came out.
January 29th, 2021.
Okay, so it was January when it came out.
Okay, that's why we never talked about it.
Yeah. It's not a bad movie, but it also wasn't great. I felt like it didn't really do anything new. The performances were maybe the best part, but I don't like Jared Leto. I think he's terrible.
I can't.
I tried.
I'm not a fan of Jared Leto either.
He likes himself way more than I could ever like him.
On Twitter when we release this episode.
Hey, Jared Leto.
not a fan. Come listen to our podcast.
So what was your favorite of the Daniel Craig 007s?
I mean, I really feel like Casino Royale is just kind of a masterclass.
That's the one I was going to say.
Spy thriller. Like,
it's
really good. It's the one that feels the most grounded. It feels the least like James Bond in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It has you on the edge of your seat the whole time.
It's just a slam dunk movie.
When he's struggling with the poison coursing through his veins, like, that was like, it had me.
Yeah.
I wanted to watch that one over and over.
I also liked Skyfall. I felt like mm-hmm. there's so, like, the plot is so inconvenient in that movie.
That's true just for improbable. A lot of James Bond films, though.
It's so improbable, for sure. But, freaking but sharks if you can with get lasers on them. That,
I mean, that's yeah. Austin Powers, but it's, I mean, it's the same.
I count Austin Powers as James Bond movies.
I was going to say, there's yeah. a reason they made all those jokes in Austin Powers. Because those might be rightful criticisms.
Yeah. But No Time to Die, I felt like, man, what a terrible note to end on. Because I'm okay with them killing Bond. I'm just not okay with anything else this movie tried to do.
I mean, it makes sense that Bond would die. He does the most dangerous shit in the world.
Oh, sure.
You know, it's gonna happen.
Yeah. And I
it's more
I
likely
think
than Steve Irwin.
They tried some stuff for the character here that I think was really ambitious, and I respect him for it. But the actual, like, nitty gritty of how it all goes down, I just was like, man, I just think this is bad. Mm. I just don't like it.
And that,
just don't like it.
That, you know, that kind of reinforces my original thought. Like, if Daniel Craig would rather die than do another one,
how could I
go watch this?
Yeah, maybe.
I bet they got pissed about him saying that.
I wonder
if that was a breach of contract or something. Like, you don't get to do that.
Maybe.
So then we went to see The Last Duel, and I liked this movie.
I loved it.
I will say that for me, I thought, like, this is one of those movies where it's like, here's a sequence of events that happened, and here's one person's perspective, and then here's the next person's perspective, and you almost see the same seasons.
The same story beats three times.
Yeah. So at times it felt a little long.
It was very repetitive.
Very repetitive. But all in all, I liked it. I thought it was a good film.
I think that the repetition for this movie works. Like, this is a Ridley Scott, Last Duel is about... It's based loosely on real, like, history of mm-hmm. the last duel in France, right? Because France, like, in French law, you could basically accuse someone of wrongdoing and then demand trial by combat.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the last duel, right, that historically ever occurred between these two.
So let's give a little insight into what happened. So Matt Damon's character is, and I just wrote Matt Damon's character is married to Jodie Comer, or Jodie Comer's character, and he's a knight. He's struggling with his local
his finances,
his local governor kind of.
Oh yeah, and
like
his,
with,
his
Ben Affleck,
the lord he serves under. To play. Pay fealty to under
yeah.
the king.
Oh, and he's man, really good friends good. With Adam Driver's character. Yeah. And it's through these three perspectives. So Ben Affleck kind of plays a side character in this, but this was actually the first collaboration between Affleck and Damon since, and they've worked together as actors, but this is the first time they worked together as screenwriters since Good Will Hunting.
Yeah. The story is basically Adam Driver is accused of raping Jodie Comer's character.
Yeah.
And Matt Damon challenges him to a duel.
And what's interesting about that is in Adam Driver's version of events, like when we see that, he still admits to, like, attacking and raping her, but it's not as violent a scene as what
she depicts.
Yeah, right. When we see her version of events.
It's really interesting. And the just the political machine kind of working against Jodie Comer
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon's kind of an asshole.
His
character is self-righteous when you see his perspective, but then when you see Jodie Comer's perspective, like, he's just as rapey and just as awful as any of the other men in this story. And I think what's really interesting about this movie is that I think it tries to have a conversation about the way we have framed history itself. Right, the way that we write these historical narratives and envision these historical narratives without really paying attention to, like, who is writing the historical narrative and how does that reshape the kinds of narratives we tell ourselves about the way that things should go.
Right.
I am so sad this movie has not made back its budget. Ridley Scott, Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon deserve much better. They at least deserve some awards.
Yeah. Because it had a $100 million budget, and it's only, I mean, the box office was real small. It was like 27.4.
And I double-checked these numbers, folks. So, like, by the time you hear this podcast, it'll be a few weeks after we've recorded it. But I double checked these numbers the night before we recorded this. So yeah. this is like up to date.
What caused such a low turnout?
Well, I mean, it is a pandemic.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of stuff that is in theaters right now that's really turning out a lot of people, you know.
And I don't think they really marketed this.
No, like, I think the biggest movie that we've seen that we're talking about really is No Time to Die. And that made, $733 million.
Even the Eternals didn't make much over there.
I think that's a world gross. Yeah. Is 733.
I think that's what I was trying to.
But it hasn't cleared, the marks that a lot of people thought it was going to try to clear. You know, Eternals is the big Marvel movie. That's only had 304
off a $200 million budget. So that's really not making, that's barely covering marketing.
It's going to make money in the long run. Mm-hmm. But the fact that, most of these Marvel movies end up making like $1 billion. Mm-hmm. For it to have been out for 2 or 3 weeks now, and to not have made that big a splash, like it's gonna be the most underperforming Marvel movie, I think.
Yeah, and it is the lowest score on Rotten Tomatoes.
That too, I think a lot of word of mouth is probably going to keep people from going.
Our word of mouth isn't helping it much either.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But The Last Duel deserves that word of mouth. It deserves
more audience.
And
I was listening to some reactions to this movie from NPR and NPR critics. I don't often agree with a lot of critics.
Yeah.
NPR was just. They really did not like this movie, and they talked a lot about what they didn't like about this movie, and I disagreed on nearly every point. I was like, I feel like you're missing the point of.
Well, a lot I don't of like NPR that down. Much, so
there you go.
Yeah, take that, Glenn Weldon.
After The Last Duel, then we had Venom, Let There Be Carnage. I wanted to see this one.
Was it Topher Grace?
No.
No Topher?
It's Bane from Batman as Venom now.
Tom Hardy does some weird stuff with Venom. This movie had...
Luckily, he doesn't do the Bane voice with Venom.
Yeah,
this movie was directed
like
by Andy Serkis, which I did not know until I actually watched the movie.
Until I wrote it down on our script?
No. I actually knew. That's when I found out. Once I saw the credits roll, I was like, holy shit, this was directed by Andy Serkis. I didn't know.
I love Woody Harrelson. Like, he's one of my favorites.
He's not very good in this movie, though. Like, if I'm being real. But I also think it's weird that they cast him as
he's an odd choice
Carnage.
For Cletus.
Because he's, how old is he now? He's in his 60s, right?
Yeah.
And this character is only supposed to be like 30.
And he's
or
got
something?
Like they give him a bad looking, a terrible looking like red
terrible
wig, like
wig.
Curly red wig.
Yeah, and he's dating a gal who's like really very clearly not even close to his age, and that's weird. There's talk about like back when I was in the orphanage or whatever, and they show, the young Woody Harrelson, and I'm like, what is happening? I just don't understand. It makes some weird choices.
Ted Danson walks in. I was just watching Cheers last night.
Yeah,
Woody Harrelson. Ted Danson walks in and is like, come run a bar with me.
Yeah.
Then this fat guy walks in, everyone's like, Norm!
Alternate timeline.
No, but on the whole, I actually liked this movie way more than I liked
You say
the
on the whole
film.
A lot. Have you noticed that?
Well, yeah.
It's kind of the theme.
It's my way of trying to wrap up all of the many loose strings we introduce.
Yeah, in total.
In total. In conclusion, in summary, let me dig out my thesaurus.
On the whole, is just a little more poetic sounding than all those other ones.
No, I thought it was. I thought it was fine. I thought it's.
And they
had
the after credit scene where they put him in the MCU now. So.
Yeah. They introduce him to the MCU.
Yeah. So
did Matt Damon do Did he do an accent? Matt Damon?
No, he no. does. Well,
none of them do an accent.
In that movie, in Last Duel, he kind of did, but not much of one.
They did more of an accent for their movie than Kevin Costner did for Robin Hood.
Ben Affleck does some weird.
That's an interesting gradient.
Ben Affleck in Last Duel is like cartoonish. His accent is so fucking weird. The moment he opened his mouth, it was like, what is he doing?
See, I. he doesn't, to me, he doesn't look like he can do an accent.
And he's got, he dyed his hair full on blonde. He's like Caesar cut.
Justin Timberlake in the early aughts blonde.
Yeah.
Like, it's, he makes some weird character choices in The Last Duel that is,
even his,
like,
didn't he have
bizarre.
Facial hair that was blonde too?
Yeah, he's got like a little goatee.
I know Ben Affleck can't do an accent.
No, he can't.
I don't know that about him. He can do a Boston accent.
But I know that about him. Yeah. He what?
He can do a Boston accent.
Oh, wicked Boston accent, huh?
But he's from Boston, so he better be able to do a Boston
accent.
Yeah,
I'd hope he'd be able to do that. Oh, man. Yeah.
So, Dune. It's another one I didn't see. I only remember Dune from it, like, as a kid when I watched, like, that. Fucking go watch this movie.
Doom, as in the video.
Dune. As in Frank
I was like, they did that again.
Sci-fi masterpiece.
Dune. Yes, my neighbor keeps texting me about this movie.
Oh my god.
Dune. Have you seen Dune?
Have you seen Dune yet?
And I was like, no, I don't even know what that is. And he's like, you gotta watch the old one first with Sting. Yeah. And I was like, Sting was in a movie.
Sting was in that movie.
Sting was in that
in
movie.
In the David
yeah.
Lynch movie. Yep. Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, it was really fucking weird. And you gotta watch it.
Yeah, fucking... well, that movie is weird because, like, everybody's whispering to themselves. No, no, for real.
And Kyle MacLachlan has, like,
yeah, Kyle MacLachlan
blue
would show
eyes
up.
That
he'd,
are like,
he'd show up and it's like, it's the Gom Jabbar. I'm the Kwisatz Haderach. They need the spice in order for the Space Guild to fly us to Arrakis. Like shit like that. It's fucking weird.
What are you talking about?
No, it's incredible.
I don't know.
This is Dune.
I figure if I talk low enough, nobody will understand. And they won't expect me to know what I'm talking
Dune
about
speak.
Either.
David Lynch is explaining the plot to us right now.
David Lynch is explaining the plot to you? You're in deep shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fucking
no,
Lost
that's,
Highway.
That's all I gotta say. That's the old Dune. No, go watch Lost Highway again, though. That movie's brilliant. Yeah. That movie's incredible.
Are we doing this again, or we're supposed to be talking about one
we're
movie?
Supposed we're supposed to be talking about one movie, and we're still just day-tripping over
Dune.
Dune.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. It's like, we
Lost
still on
Highway
the
was
last
another, to, like, early, to, or was it, yeah, it's an early aughts
yeah,
classic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this, like, Eraserhead, Twin Peaks, I mean, David Lynch is... Wow.
But getting back to Denis Villeneuve's Dune.
Yeah, let's get off.
No, this movie's a slam dunk.
Cool, I'll have to watch
Freaking
it.
Freaking great. It's gorgeous. The music is
I wonder if
mind
it's still
blowing.
On HBO Max.
I don't know. It'll come
the,
back.
The music. It all right.
Yeah, the mute dude.
Is it like the symphonic, like movie score?
No,
or is it
well,
like kind of...
No, it's... who's the composer?
I didn't look that up, damn it.
John Williams?
It's not John Williams.
I failed on my writing duties.
No, it's the guy who did all the Zack Snyder soundtracks and stuff.
Oh, did he do the Christopher Nolan?
Yeah.
Zimmer?
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Hans Zimmer.
Yeah.
Hans Zimmer
oh,
does.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
okay, yeah.
He does the soundtrack
yeah.
to this film. And
wonderful.
It is mind-boggling.
Yes.
It's cool. So good.
Very see, to cool. me, personally, music is extremely crucial to
oh,
making
yeah.
me care
oh,
about
yeah.
a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
I can't do it if there's no score.
Yeah.
Because I'll remember that music for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And it has those images from the movie tied to it.
Hans Zimmer's score serves the, like, Villeneuve's visuals immaculately.
Wow. Man,
it is a film that is absolutely gorgeous to watch. Story-wise, I had some issues. Just because I think that it needs to be a 4-hour long movie and it's only 2.5 hours.
Right.
Well, and I heard they cut out some stuff that was like really intrinsic to the plot.
Pivotal. Like, well, not necessarily the plot, but like pivotal to the characterization.
Gotcha.
And I think that's what bothered me so much was just that, you know, this movie is so dependent on its characters to work, and the stuff that they cut out for time, unfortunately, is all of the stuff that I would have kept in because it's so pivotal to the characters.
Right, right.
But otherwise, I mean, if you can get past the weird jankiness of like cutting so much out of the plot in order to make it work for a 2.5-hour movie, it's visually stunning. And cool. I think that it gives vision to the novel. That is one of my, it's in my top 10 favorite novels of all time. It gives service to the novel that I think is just so fun to see.
Nice.
It's really, really cool.
Toto did the music for the first one.
Toto?
Yeah. It's, that movie, I'm telling you, the old 80s one is wild.
I miss the rains
wild.
Down in Africa.
It's pretty crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, that was,
they missed the rains down on Arrakis.
Yeah, a lot of people probably don't know who Toto are.
They wouldn't get the joke. They wouldn't get the joke meme with like Dorothy holding her dog, and she's like, "I miss Kansas," and he's like, "I miss the rains down in Africa."
That's good. That's
good. Okay, so you've convinced me. I need to go watch Dune.
Yeah.
How about? Oh God. We got to talk about this one, don't we?
I mean, just briefly, reminiscence.
Like reminiscence. Let's reminisce about reminiscence and how not a joy it was, Lisa Joy, to watch this film. See what I did there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hugh Jackman and Rebecca Ferguson are in this
Hugh
movie.
Jackass.
Yeah. Huge Jackman.
Huge Jackass.
Huge Jackass.
He's never heard that in his entire life.
This
probably
movie
not.
Is
no,
exhausting.
I'm original in that way. Yeah.
It really was exhausting.
I'm not derivative in any ways. By any means. No. Yeah, this movie was exhausting.
Yeah,
talk about not making back its budget.
Yeah, well, ooh. and this is weird because it was one of those movies that was like streamed on HBO Max at the same time as it came out.
That's
in
where
theaters.
We caught it. We didn't even bother going
yeah,
to the theater.
Because I knew it was going to be bad. It looked
is
like
it noir?
A whole bunch
is
of
it
trash.
Sci-fi? Is it sci-fi wanting to be noir?
It's bad. And the thing that I was thinking about after it was done is like noir usually only works, you know, so much as like we're kind of caught up in the character's head and we sympathize with the character,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like there has to be a kind of sympathy for the narrator in order for this to work. But if you see Hugh Jackman,
Huge Jacked Man,
I only know him as Huge Jacked Man. If you see huge Jackman,
he can't even not say it.
I can't not do it. And you no, if you see him and you see that he's also a huge jackass, like you don't give a shit about him, you know?
Right.
So I felt like as a noir story, it only works so much as you like are actually invested in this dude's life and like feel sympathy for
and
him.
We're not slamming like this idea of noir being mixed like with another genre because it
right.
can work. Like
it can work.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit? One of my favorite
sure.
noir films. That's like a cartoon and
ooh.
Like adventure comedy as well too. And
yeah.
we were
and
talking about Christopher Lloyd earlier and talk about another like creepy ass performance mm-hmm. by Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
In that fucking
yeah. No.
Movie.
Mind altering.
Yeah.
Performance by Christopher Lloyd.
But
yeah.
But there, I mean, that they understood the concepts of noir even in that kind of film, and I
yeah.
don't think Lisa Joy gets it.
No, I really don't think she does. And as much
she doesn't
as I could
understand
look,
dialect.
As much as I could look at Rebecca Ferguson all day, because I can look at Rebecca Ferguson all day. She was a dude.
She was in Dune.
Wasn't she?
She was in Dune. I think
yeah.
she was in Dune.
She was. She plays the Lady Jessica.
I don't know. I didn't see
I'm on board. Like, no.
We
got to
go
I,
see Dune, man.
What's her name?
We
got to
see
Rebecca
Dune.
Ferguson. I could stare at that woman all day. Like legitimately.
I'm about
but
to find out if I can.
This movie sucked. Oh, yeah. My gosh. It sucked.
Okay,
reminiscence, not Dune.
I'm looking at yeah. pictures
no,
of
Dune
Rebecca
another
Ferguson.
Another movie that
fantastic.
Sucked. While Curtis is looking up Rebecca Ferguson so that 2/3 of Slay House Publishing Presents Lit Bits can have... shit, my joke just went flat because I forgot what I was going to phrase it.
Don't you love that?
Yeah.
Did Lisa Joy direct your joke?
Lisa Joy directed my joke.
You can circle back. I'll change the subject, then you circle back.
All right.
And, so, yeah, damn. This Rebecca Ferguson, pretty attractive young lady there.
I'm telling you, I could yeah. look at her for
Jeremy,
for
got
days.
Anything you want to add?
I thought I did, but I've just lost
oh,
it.
Oh, like, I let you circle back, right. too.
Malignant. James Wan.
Stalking charges against them. 2/3 of Lit See the Joke fell flat now. Because you're both talking about you could watch her.
All the pieces are there.
All the way.
Put it all together,
and,
someone.
And,
I'll
yeah,
go to jail
and,
for Rebecca Ferguson.
Yeah. And you're stalking. We're stuck. Okay, so Malignant. James Wan's Ode to Farce.
Oh, man.
Man, what a fucking movie.
Yeah, Malignant? It's weird because, so this was supposed to be like the big
made my
horror,
brain feel Malignant.
Yeah, the big horror movie of the fall, other than maybe Halloween Kills, right?
Yeah.
But it was supposed to be the big horror movie and comes out, it was simultaneously released in theaters and on HBO Max and was supposed to be this tour de force of horror because James Wan is the voice of like new horror, right? He did the Conjuring movies and
oh,
those
okay.
were a smash hit that launched its own
they're not
like,
really
weird
that great
cinematic.
Either. We could do a whole episode on like the Conjuring universe.
Yeah. I do not like those movies, but a lot of people love them and think they're great. And Malignant was one of those movies that came out, and it was like his return to horror after doing some other movies.
Like, whatever you were doing before, why don't you go back to it?
Yeah, and was supposed to be like this, this slam dunk kind of horror movie. And people in the horror world were like, oh, I loved it. It was so great. Or they were like, what the fuck are you smoking? Because this movie is terrible. And I fall on that. Like, this movie is fucking terrible, man.
I mean, it sets up like the date
polarizing
for Quado on like Total Recall.
Yeah. So what was the conjoined twin growing out of the dude's stomach.
Yeah.
And he leads the freedom fighters in Total Recall.
Yeah.
Directed by Paul Verhoeven, who also directed his Starship Troopers.
See how this all comes around.
Everything ties back. It all comes together. God.
This is basically the premise of Malignant. This woman's got a conjoined twin coming
in
out of her
back
head.
Back of her head.
And it takes over. So, like, the villain that you see shadowy, like,
yeah.
I'm going to fucking spoil this
James
movie.
Wan. James Wan watched Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, where the Voldemort comes out of the back of Professor Quirrell's head, and it's like, there's a movie there.
And the whole thing, the villain, the big monster, is her running backwards because taking over her body. Because
you think that it's like this weird doppelganger or something, this demon or something. And no, it's just the conjoined twin. And what was stupid was at the beginning of the movie where they show, they're like foreshadowing the rest of the movie where they're doing surgery on this girl. And you know that it's this deformed twin in the back of her head or whatever that they're removing. The moment that scene opens up, I looked at Jeremy and I said, please tell me that this movie is about a fucking conjoined twin that goes on murder sprees.
That's exactly what it fucking was.
My favorite parts of the movie, she rips a woman's heart out just with her bare hands, like sticks it in her Kali Ma style. She like pulls it out.
Indiana Jones reference.
Yeah, Indiana Jones reference. See, everything comes back around.
Swish. Everything comes back around. Everything comes back
around. No, she pulls it out of her chest but then later she throws like a whole fucking hospital bed on this woman, and she goes like, once she defeats the dumb conjoined twin in her brain or whatever and comes back to her senses, she's like human again, and so she's trying to lift this hospital bed, and they're like, can you do it? Are you strong enough? She's like, if I was strong enough to throw it, I'm strong enough to pick it up.
And she blows her hernia.
Fiery.
Which is dumb, because I'm just like, are you telling me legitimately that I can Kali Ma someone's fucking heart out of their chest if I just think hard enough about doing it? You're telling me that my ethical standards are what keep me from punching through someone's fucking chest?
Yeah.
Here's my Jerry Springer moment to this, all right? We all have our conjoined twins to deal with in our life, and I just want you to recognize that you have that issue, and that the people you're around have their own conjoined twins to deal with too, so be kind to each other.
What's your conjoined twin?
On the next Jerry Springer.
Metaphorical.
So
bad movie.
Bad movie. But the last movie we are going to talk about, I am fucking legit excited to talk about this movie. Like, okay, when I looked these numbers up last night, I want to tell. So think about this for a minute. So this next movie that we're going to talk about has only, by the time of recording, has only been out for 3 days, right?
Yeah.
Has a $75 million budget. Mm-hmm. I looked it up last night, and it had earned back $16.5 million. And I put in our script that that's at the time of recording. But as we were going on about these bad movies, I picked up my phone and Googled this movie again. From last night to today, that number is up to $60 million it's earned at the box office.
Nice. Well, keep in mind, first off, like opening weekends typically do that well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think it would be a really bad sign if it didn't do that well. I don't think this movie is going to pass like $300 million, $400 million.
I don't know.
I just don't feel like it's got that kind of a. I don't think moviegoers are going to movies as much.
I don't think they are either. But I think if any of these movies had the potential to do that,
I do think it'll make a good profit.
It's going
to
earn its money back. It's almost already earned its money back.
Well, and I think it'll do fine.
So I want to frame discussion of this last movie with our subject from last week when we talk about Star Wars and we go on and on railing against J.J. Abrams.
We are talking about Ghostbusters Afterlife.
We are talking about Ghostbusters.
I don't feel like we
said that. No, I was building up to that. I was trying to make it a surprise.
Who you going to call?
Hey!
Ghostbusters.
When Joaquin Bodine, what's his name? Joaquin Bodine? Joaquin Bodine? You know what I'm trying to say the actor's name.
Joaquin Woodbine?
It's stressing me out listening to you try to say that.
It's written here on the script.
You're like not even looking at it. I'm not even looking at the script.
It's like an old man thing. It's like, let me adjust my bifocals here. He looks at he's so tongue-in-cheek when he looks at McKenna Grace, and he's like,
oh yeah,
she's like, I have a right to a phone call, don't I? And he's like, who you gonna call?
Oh god,
that's actually
obligatory.
You know what though, I felt like it was earned. Like I didn't mind the
pun. I laughed.
Man. I mean, that's what it was there for. It was self-referential. Here's why Ghostbusters Afterlife works as a sequel soft reboot, where like the Star Wars Abrams and Rian Johnson Star Wars films don't. It's because the director understands the characters. He understands the universe that he's building because he grew up in it. The director is Jason Reitman, son of Ivan Reitman. Ivan Reitman was on the set as well. And Bill Murray at one point says to Ivan Reitman, first time he picks up the proton packs on this new set, he's like, man, these things are so much lighter than what we carried around back in the day.
He was still complaining about it.
He was still complaining
like
about
Bill
it.
Bill Murray was.
Yeah. But I love that they do kill off one of the original Ghostbusters in here. But spoiler alert, Harold Ramis died like a few years ago.
Yeah.
So this was more of an homage to him.
Yeah.
I felt like when they were tearing up at the end, like I teared up.
Ivan Reitman was the director of the
first. Ivan Reitman directed the first two.
Harold Ramis is so cool.
And here's the other thing too. I could be accused probably of being one of these, like if I tell you I hate the Paul Feige version or whatever.
Yeah, the 2016.
The 2016 version. You're going to be like, oh, because it was all women. It's not because it was all women. It's because he did not understand the universe. He did not understand the source material.
To be fair, I haven't seen the 2016 version, so I don't.
I mean, those women are all funny. They're all really funny. I just don't think the story worked. And I think what it was is we talked about appropriation, like as if it's something that it's always been yours.
Yeah.
He doesn't pay that reference. It's almost like plagiarism. He doesn't pay that reference to the original source material.
To throw this out here, because I'm just feeding this out, right? Like, if you are rebooting something like what Paul Feig was doing with the 2016 one, if you're rebooting, how much reverence do you need to show to the original, like to the originals? Do you need to pay reference or deference to the original characters if you're not using those characters anymore?
But he uses some of the actors. Like Bill Murray comes back and Sigourney Weaver comes back. And I think Dan Aykroyd
comes. But are they the same characters? No. They're not the same
actors. No, they're not the same characters, but they're the same actors. They're not the same characters. But it's that in reference joke. Like, we're not going to attribute, even though we're very clearly taking the story, we're not going to at all attribute to the original story. But here's for those of you who really want one, here's a little in-universe wink by using some of this original actors. And it's like almost a slap in the face.
Right. Yeah.
Like, he could have said, you know, he could have done what they did in this movie where it's like, hey, the thing in 84 happened. Here, let's build off of that. And that's exactly what they did in this film. And they make it their own. They bring us new characters that we care about.
So one of the things that works for me in Ghostbusters Afterlife and doesn't work for me in something similar, I think, because we're making comparisons to Star Wars, right?
Right.
I talked about it in the Star Wars Update 1995. You know, one of the things that I really did not like about the new Star Wars stuff is that it ignores the character development from the original source material. And so even though it gives us new stories with those characters or whatever and tries to give us new characters that we can fall in love with alongside the other original characters, it does the original characters so dirty in terms of their development and really goes back on all of the things that we know and have believed about those characters for however long.
Right. And this movie doesn't. This movie gets the original characters right.
I think that what it does is, well, first off, smartest decision that I think this movie makes is giving us brand new characters to deal with in the same, you know, kind of universe that we like, that we can actually grow with alongside the movie. And they are not overshadowed at any point in time by the original characters that we fell in love with back in the 80s.
Right? Yeah.
So,
but two, like with the case of Star Wars, like Star Wars gave us a bunch of brand new characters, but then
they were overshadowed. I think the problem with the new characters is they're overshadowed by the returning or the returning cast. And in order, I think, for us to care more about the new characters, they give us like, or they write off or write out the original characters in a way that I think is, again, like not true to what we know of those characters.
Exactly.
And so in order to give us the new characters we care about, they throw away the old
And they
stuff.
Try to make a mystery, like, but Abrams admitted, like, he didn't know where the trilogy was going when he started writing it.
Well, that was another fucking problem.
But they tried to make
Abrams
a mystery of, like,
bad
how these...
storyteller.
Oh, yeah, he's absolutely a terrible storyteller. But they didn't know where the characters were, like, how they would be connected to the original cast. Yeah. And here, in Ghostbusters Afterlife, we know, they don't show us Harold Ramis as Egon Spengler at the beginning. I looked at my wife, because she was there watching it with me, and it's like, that's very clearly supposed to be like an older Egon Spengler.
Yeah.
Like they kind of hide it from you, but they can't show you because it's Harold Ramis has passed away. So they have a stand-in actor. But it's very clearly that's who that character is supposed to be.
Right.
So when the family comes in, then they set up these stakes to tie it to one of the original Ghostbusters. So we see that link there. We're given kind of that continuity to care about these new characters.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, just throwing this out there, I don't even necessarily know that we needed that generational link for these characters.
Maybe not, but it was nice
because
to
I think the characters themselves are interesting enough that I was, you know, like McKenna Grace.
She does a phenomenal job.
That character Phoebe, I was invested 100%. I thought that
so
was
much
so
better
fun
job in that than in Malignant. She's in both.
Oh, is she really?
She's
completely blocked out my brain.
I think
she
plays
the
little, the
You're totally right. She plays the young version of
whatever the character
Annabelle
name.
Wallace.
Or, yeah.
The actress.
And for those of you who might know the name but don't necessarily know what she's been in, she was also in The Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah.
On Netflix.
I think she's a young actor that you should put on your radar.
She sings that song at the end during the credits.
What was her name?
Oh yeah, the
McKenna Grace.
McKenna Grace.
Yeah.
The ghosts in this house or whatever that song is.
I could have used a little bit more Paul Rudd in this movie.
Yeah.
But I just feel like everything needs. Yeah, Grant Gruberson.
they get some good jokes out of that. His name is Greg Gruberson.
I feel like all of these characters really work in their own right.
I could use some more Olivia Wilde.
More Olivia Wilde. You want to talk about
it's
obsessions.
Not the first time I've heard someone say that.
Like, I am so obsessed with Olivia Wilde. So obsessed with her.
Yeah.
I kept making jokes. Like, I made one on Twitter. Like, Gozer, the demon that they're trying to resurrect, who was also in the first movie, right?
Olivia Wilde in the first movie.
Yeah, anytime I watch a movie and it's like, I want to resurrect this ancient god or something like that, I'm like, but why? Why do you want to do that?
Chaos.
Like, is your life really so shitty that you really think that that's gonna work? But then they show up and Gozer is played by Olivia Wilde, and I was like, I get it. I would be in that cult for sure.
I love that when the Ghostbusters the original do come in and that's the big fight scene at the end, and she looks at him and says, you know, are you a god, like from the first one?
Yeah.
And Ray, like Dan Aykroyd's going, and Bill Murray and Ernie Hudson just look at him like, you got to be kidding me. Like, come on, man. yes, we're gods. They're like, I think she remembers us.
We just spoiled the whole movie.
I don't give a shit. I love that movie.
If you're going to go see Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Actually, we won't have spoiled it because by the time this comes out, it'll be a few weeks old.
Wait, so is Gozer the one who kidnaps the baby in the...
No, that's the sequel. That's some Carpathian wizard
the
guy.
Weird guy.
Which that also is like
Gozer
canon.
Gozer is the one that lives in the freezer, right? Or the fridge.
Oh,
when,
okay.
The gate, they're, you know, the gatekeeper is trying to get to the keymaster, and
yeah.
then they
yeah.
they resurrect Gozer, and
the character designs are like really cohesive, so I mix them up with
yeah,
the,
yeah, yeah.
You know, because
yeah.
I'm looking
I mean,
at Olivia it, Wilde.
Even this, yeah, even the style looks. Really, really
yeah,
good.
They did a good
it's
job.
Yeah, I really kind of want to see it.
She looks a whole lot like the old Gozer,
yeah.
but also she looks like Olivia Wilde. As soon as I saw her, it was like, oh man.
Like I thought I didn't realize it was Olivia Wilde. I'll admit that. Like I didn't.
I knew I it didn't. The moment I saw her.
I wouldn't.
Like, oh
no,
shit!
I wouldn't have known either.
Maybe it's just because I'm obsessed with Olivia Wilde. But
yeah.
I've never seen her look undesirable.
So both Olivia
yeah,
Wilde
so
and
weird.
Rebecca Ferguson are going to be getting those restraining orders
you know,
on two-thirds of Slay House
them
Lipets.
And what's-her-face, Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, well, Jennifer and Connelly. I was like all talking up Salma Hayek, who's still gorgeous to this day, so it's like,
oh,
you know,
yeah, sure.
We're all going to jail.
I don't think I'm as obsessed with Salma Hayek as like Jennifer Connelly.
Dude,
for
watch
sure.
From Dusk Till Dawn.
I've seen it. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
No, for me, Jennifer Connelly.
From Dusk Till Dawn.
My formative moment was The Rocketeer. Where
you didn't like From Dusk Till
Dawn? Rocketeer.
The Rocketeer. Oh, yeah.
I love The Rocketeer.
No, I liked it. It was just.
It was
like,
insane.
I felt like I was having a weird fever dream the whole time.
Oh, yeah. That's what I loved about it. Though.
Quentin Tarantino's character was like disgusting.
Oh, he was. Oh, yeah.
We're talking about
terrible.
The same movie, right?
Yeah. It starts out as like this crime spree bank robbers thing, and then
yeah,
it turns into
yeah.
them going to a strip club in Mexico with vampires.
The whole thing was so damn
Salma
Hayek bizarre.
Is a, yeah.
And
she does
she's
a dance.
Yeah. She, oh, man. That, okay.
Anyway.
But we're talking about Ghostbusters
I don't know.
Afterlife.
I'm saying, like, I don't know. Olivia Wilde for me.
I love this
Olivia Wilde
freaking
for me.
Movie. I thought this movie was great. I thought Finn Wolfhard was great in this film. I thought I'm not seeing Carrie Coon in a
we
lot of
share
stuff.
We share a name. The character.
Yeah. He's a Trevor.
Yeah.
He's a Trevor.
The first Trevor that I've in
Trevor.
A film.
I'm seeing Trevor pop up like all over the place.
I've seen him like the name crop up in a couple of films, but he's always like I don't know.
I'm
some
seeing it on TV
dork.
A lot too. I'm seeing a
like,
lot of Trevors.
He's never like a really good character, and now I feel like I've finally found
it's like that
my
Star Trek
cultural...
episode, The Trouble with Trevors.
The Trouble yeah. with Trevor.
Well, yeah, that'd be I. Hey, just Photoshop me over all of the tribbles. In that movie.
If Harold Ramis were still alive, how do you think they would have what do you think this movie would have done
so
with that?
This is a really interesting ethical question,
yeah.
right? Which is like, what do you do with a dead actor
right.
or actress? Like, you know, do you continue
pay homage
to use
without
their...
making it seem cheesy and
exactly.
And I think they did. I
very
think they respected him.
Cool.
But I mean, very cynically too, like there is this feeling that if you digitize someone after they're dead, mm-hmm. you know, like, is that not you just using their dead, like capitalizing on their dead likeness, you know, for more money? I understand the ethics there because it's like, even as an actor, you can't even necessarily have autonomy, you know, over like your acting career post death.
Surely Reitman
because they're just
going to
resurrect
from...
you.
Well, moving forward, that might be a thing that the actors figure out before they die, because it's going to be like a common thing that after an actor dies, you digitize them and you use
Reitman
AI
went
to
and like talked
them.
To the family and was like, "Here's my
well,
family."
So,
yeah.
so from what I hear,
will,
from
something.
What I hear, like on most accounts, they're like Harold Ramis would probably have been very proud of this movie,
right?
Yeah.
And like his like being involved, like after death in a movie like this, like Ghostbusters. You know, and so
this was his and Dan Aykroyd's brainchild. I mean, they were very
to that extent. I feel like the there is a lot of homage here.
Yeah.
You know, it's right. done very lovingly, and I don't think that it's done necessarily for like a very cynical purpose.
No,
right.
You know,
I didn't feel like this was just a moneymaker. Like, let's use this and
yeah,
like
right.
I'm more cynical but, about the use of the original characters in the Abrams Star Wars films than.
Yeah. Oh,
here.
Yeah. No, I
here like when like at the very end, it gave the three guys a chance as their characters on screen to say that public goodbye
yeah.
to not just Egon Spengler, but to Ramis himself. I
right.
felt
right.
like, and I was tearing up. I was like, when they showed like the image of him helping his granddaughter hold the thing, and
it was
the
like
proton
it's
pack.
Definitely played for effect, like for
I'm,
sure,
and it works,
man.
It works.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can see myself falling on either side of this argument where I'm like, you know, like actors should be able to maintain their autonomy after death. and like resurrecting them for whatever your fucking weirdo pet project is real fucking creepy to me. You know, like Carrie Fisher in this, in Star Wars, like, you know, cause she died before she concluded filming that last Star Wars movie.
I forgot she died.
Holy cow. But then she's in the movie and she's digitized. Paul Walker, they did the same thing to him in the Fast and Furious movies.
I didn't like that.
No.
Of course, there's nothing very tasteful about any of those movies in the first place. Right.
No. And there's also some weird, you know, like in the, in again, going back to Star Wars, like.
50 years from now, let's study our film school. Let's watch The Fast and the Furious.
No, but Peter Cushing shows up in Rogue One, right? Like they digitize Peter Cushing and his likeness to be Grand Moff Tarkin again.
And Carrie Fisher in that too.
And they present the same thing.
There I can understand. I mean, they're providing a continuity to the original films, and they're
right. And then there's another question. It's like, you know, just because that actor portrayed that character is not the character separate from the actor, right? As a fictional entity. And then you have to ask, you know, weird questions like in the depiction of that character, you know, is that character the likeness that you're depicting, or is it, you know, Peter Cushing? I think it gets weird.
Right. Yeah.
And again, you know, I think that ethically there are some weird boundaries that you're kind of dealing with regard to entertainment. And
there are, but I do feel like the what they do with Harold Ramis and Ghostbusters Afterlife is right on target. Like I feel like that was terrifically handled.
That's good to know.
And I felt like everything was done very reverentially. Yes. I felt like this movie really does look back at the spirit of the original two movies and was like, let's have fun with this. Let's like renovate this old house for a newer audience, and you know, like kind of re-deliver
to the metaphorically the kind of and the after credit scenes.
Oh yeah.
Which I had to text Trevor and tell him that there were two after credit. I didn't know if you might have known that already, but
I always stay to the end of every movie that I go see though.
Like, yeah, there are two after credit scenes. It's like they list like the characters and it's like, and Sigourney Weaver, and she hadn't been in any part of the film. And it's like, wait, where's Sigourney Weaver? And then the first after credit scene pops up and it's her doing the psychic cards like Peter Venkman's doing in the first one, where he's like, I never shocked the girls. I always shocked because he was hitting on the girls.
Oh, okay.
So he's like holding up the cards, like, what is this? And
she's
and like
electrocuting
so
him.
She's like doing it now, and he's hooked up to the electrodes. Oh, nice. And she's like, you probably marked these, didn't you? And he's like, no. And she shocks him, and he's like, yeah.
It's fun. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, again, as trying to reinvent a new Ghostbusters, this movie serves as, I mean, soft reboot. It kind of feels a little bit reiterative because it borrows so many story beats from the first movie.
Yeah.
And if you know that movie really, really well, I feel like you're going to see this movie and be like, well, they just kind of did the same thing that I've already seen.
Right.
But I felt like that's part of the fun. It's part of the spirit. And I think it's part of the reintroduction of Ghostbusters with this little renovation to be like, look, we can still make this a fun film for a lot of viewers and hopefully launch a franchise that, like, I'm kind of angry that it took us 40 fucking years or whatever, you know, almost to get another Ghostbusters movie.
Right.
Winston Zeddemore is now rich. He's opened up the house again. They've got the Ecto-1 back. I mean, you know, they're setting up a franchise for this. Like they're doing this.
Oh,
like,
I know they're setting
and
up Dana
Barrett's son Oscar was nowhere in this. I mean, he could totally be like the new. He'd be 30 something years old now.
I was
kind of
sad what's his face wasn't in this movie.
Oh, Rick Moranis.
Rick Moranis.
Maybe he could be.
But I haven't seen Rick Moranis in a movie. Well, he stopped acting, right?
Yeah, I think his wife died, didn't she?
Yeah, I think.
And he's stopped to raise his kids.
I think he's been doing some stage acting.
Paul
lately.
Rudd kind of takes the Rick Moranis role in this.
Paul Rudd is so fun. It needed more Paul Rudd, but I also hope that they...
Everything needs more Paul Rudd.
Yeah, I feel like even movies with Paul Rudd, I would like more Paul Rudd.
Yeah.
No, I feel like
Celery
give
Man.
Give him more Celery Man.
Now Tane, I can get into.
Tane, something I can get into.
Show me a printout of Oyster smiling.
You guys warped my brain wobble. Showing me that video. Like, that destroyed me. That
I love it.
Yeah, Google Celery Man. Yeah, Paul Rudd.
And can you kick up the 3D?
Your wife's calling. It's an emergency. Tell her I call her back. We've got important work to
we
do.
We got more work to do.
Yeah, he was so awesome. This movie was an A+. Like, of all the movies on our list, I feel like this is the A+ movie. Like, this is probably the only A movie for me on this list.
For me, I mean, Dune. It was a slam dunk. Yeah. I really, really loved Dune. But yeah, I agree. I mean, in a year of like struggling to find the right movie, I feel like Ghostbusters Afterlife was the first one that I walked away from being like, really like, all right, I feel like there's momentum here.
Nice.
Like movies can be back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, everybody. That is our movie review for the fall of 2021. So I'm sure we're going to be seeing more movies because, you know, if we're not reading books, we're watching movies. So we're definitely going to be doing a new movie review coming the new year. And with our next season, we've got still some good episodes coming out. We got a great interview coming up with one of our Slay House people, fellow author Karen Huff. We have a 4-part series on Dracula. We have some year-end review stuff that we're looking at.
Yeah,
we've got our anthology that we're working on that should be out. Christmas special on the way. We have StokerCon coming up. We're going to be at StokerCon. This is just the beginning for Slay House. We want to thank our producers, Curtis and Les at Wayne Howard Studios.
And welcome Curtis as a permanent member.
And welcome Curtis again as our permanent third host.
I'm glad to be here. It feels comfortable.
It does. It does.
It's
really nice to have that third voice here. And I love the energy that we've got going. So this is just the beginning, folks. This is just not the beginning of this episode. This is the end of this episode. This is just the beginning of what Slay House is going to do, though.
It is only the beginning.
We've only just begun. All right, I'm done.
No. Keep singing. I love the Carpenters.
Shut it down. All right, everyone. Have a good one.